Welcome, everybody. I'm Mark Peter Davis, Managing Partner of Interplay. I'm on a mission to help entrepreneurs advance society, and this podcast is definitively part of that effort. All right, today we're going to play a segment from our annual meeting. Now, as a venture capitalist, we do an annual meeting annually to update our investors, our limited partners. And typically when VCs do these meetings, they weave in some content. Usually CEOs of the portfolio companies will come in and speak to help educate and share information that the VCs are seeing on the front lines of the market. So to that end, we had a panel where Mike and I talked to two really strong founders from our portfolio, Todd, the co-founder and CEO of Broadloom, and Chet, the co-founder and CTO of Pepper, about how they think about vertical SaaS. B2B vertical SaaS is actually a really interesting segment of the market that we at Interplay spend a lot of time looking at and have a lot of investments in and around that space. So I think it's a pretty well-informed group conversation and very candid. So I hope you enjoy.
Welcome, guys. Excited today to have two of our favorite portfolio company founders here to discuss their business and vertical SaaS in today's market. With that, I will turn it over for quick introductions from the two of you, and we'll jump into a friendly conversation.
You want to take it?
Sure. My name's Chetan Narayan. I'm co-founder and CTO of Pepper. Pepper started about 4 years ago to build software for the $1 trillion food distribution market. So food distribution is something that we all interact with every day of our lives. Everyone's got to eat, but we tend to interact with the food supply chain at the retail layer. And what we learned during our previous role at Uber Eats, where we met lots and lots and lots of restaurants, is that the process of getting food to that point of retail, whether it's a restaurant, a grocery store, a convenience store, is actually super complicated. So we hopped in around 4 years ago to start to work with food distribution and build technology and digital services to help the food supply chain operate a lot more efficiently.
Awesome. And I'm Todd Saunders. I'm the CEO of a company called Broadloom. We are a vertical SaaS company for the flooring industry. So just like everyone needs to eat, I think everyone also needs to walk on floors, or, you know, I don't know what you would do if you weren't. We do full vertical software. So website, CRM, ERP, and payment processing. We kind of refer to ourselves as like a business in a box for a local flooring retailer. We have about 4,000 local flooring stores that we work with today. And if you're asking yourself how I got into flooring, that's a much longer question. But to make a long story short, I started my career at Google, was there for a few years. We launched an ad tech company, which I think you guys invested when you were an ad tech company, or right afterwards?
We met when you were an ad tech company.
Met when you were an ad tech company, pivoted into a vertical SaaS company for the flooring industry. It's where Interplay came in, and the rest is history.
I'm pretty sure the term vertical SaaS hadn't really been coined when you had made this pivot, but you were an early adopter of it. So.
Yeah, early adopter, I guess, of that, and making the flooring industry cool, I guess.
Cool again? Nice.
Yeah, exactly. I wasn't going to go there, but you got it.
Yeah, I think that kind of begs a question, right? I don't think most entrepreneurs wake up and say, hey, I'm going to do vertical SaaS. They see an industry that they feel is defective and stumble into a vertical SaaS model and approach. What got you guys thinking, hey, this is something I want to kind of lean into? What's your individual stories? You want to go first?
Sure, yeah.
So how you landed here?
Absolutely. So I, in my previous role, was the first product manager on Uber Eats. And I joined at a point in time where it wasn't even called Uber Eats. And there were five of us kind of driving around in cars with sandwiches, trying to figure out how to sell the things. And I was there all the way up through, you know, became a multi-billion-dollar business eventually. Spent a lot of time with restaurants, and restaurants, they used to just talk to us about, hey, like, these are the problems that I'm seeing in my business. They always used to talk about problems on the demand side, and that's what Uber Eats was for. But they also used to talk about all of the difficulties and challenges that they had working with their wholesalers and distributors. And that kind of opened our eyes to the other side of the food supply chain, where, you know, there's all of this stuff that happens in the background. So in New York, every day up in Hunts Point, there are thousands of people that wake up at 3 a.m. moving around boxes of tomatoes and cucumbers and everything you can imagine, and truck them to all the restaurants and convenience stores and grocery stores before we all wake up. And it's that whole industry that for a long time has just been underserved with technology. And, you know, we were exposed to that. And the things that we learned through restaurants is that the way that they interact with these wholesalers is still through text message, phone call, email. And you go talk to distributors, they're equally annoyed by people calling them up at 3 a.m. and screaming about spinach. And you look at that from the perspective of someone in the tech industry and you're like, okay, there's clearly things that technology can do to help. But then the more time you spend with food distributors, the more you appreciate the scale of the industry. And you learn that there's $1 trillion a year in sales between food distributors and retailers. You learn that for a lot of distributors, everything from finding their next set of customers to figuring out how to nurture and upsell existing customers to figuring out the right inventory levels so they're not wasting a bunch of food to figuring out pricing to figuring out logistics is still run off pen and paper. And you realize that there's an opportunity for someone to come in and build a lot of the same technologies, data, insight that have helped a lot of other industries flourish over the last couple of decades as they've embraced e-commerce and bring it to this world.
That's one of the themes as we see vertical SaaS companies is this general concept that someone's turning over a rock and finding out the internet kind of hadn't made its way underneath that rock yet. And there's an opportunity to kind of tech enable in a place where maybe it's 10, 20 years too late, right? So it's kind of these fallow, underdeveloped tech worlds that you have these tech, you know, you have tech entrepreneurs bumping into, seeing it, shocked, and then they see an opportunity to do things in a better way.
Yeah, I think when I hear stories of vertical SaaS companies, they're all, how we got into it is very different. You know, you had experience at Uber Eats. I did not have experience in flooring. Our story is we were an ad tech company and one of our customers was a website company for the flooring industry. And they were just a channel partner. And for the first time, we like looked at our data and we're like, this cohort of customers has like a 90% logo retention. And this cohort has got, our horizontal ad tech was like 70% retention. But when we were partnered with this website company, it was like 90% retention. And that opened our eyes. And then a similar experience, I think, to most vertical SaaS companies, you open up the hood and you realize like the process is painful. They're in the stone ages on everything. And to your point, like, a lot of our customers feel like we're telling the future. And the truth is we already know how this plays out because you can just look at other industries and apply it to your archaic industry. I mean, I think one of the hardest challenges we have as vertical SaaS companies is not necessarily the innovation because all of our industries are 10 years behind where everyone else is. So we have a roadmap of where we kind of have to go. I think the hard part is how do you get adoption and how do you get scale and how do you make the TAM large enough to, you know, keep that compounding? But every vertical SaaS story I hear, like I could have taken out distributors and put in flooring distributors and flooring stores, and I could have given you the same exact answer. I think that thought process of going down the supply chain and the painful experience is like every single vertical SaaS company and what gets you going every morning.
And macro, that's very different than a lot of other companies we see in the tech landscape, right? Where people are building the next CRM, the next newsletter tool, and it's this. They're competing with other tech people. The kind of the sub story of vertical SaaS is upgrading old industries to modern tech practices. And it's a process of discovery of like these pioneers who stumble into an area and like, wait, internet hasn't got here yet. And then they figure out they're going to just go do it.
Yeah.
So that's a fascinating kind of way to look at this particular market segment.
Yeah. I think there's another thing to look at there, which is like every vertical SaaS company, I think we used to look at vertical SaaS companies as what is the TAM of flooring software, right? The TAM for flooring software, we've estimated to be like 800 million, right? And you would first look at that and you'd be like, that's not big enough. But if then you look at what vertical software is doing, they're all eventually going after the GDP or, you know, for us, the $76 billion of flooring that's bought and sold. And that's actually where you get through. And if you look at how all these vertical SaaS companies, Toast, Slice, all these big guys, how they got this big is fintech or taking a percent of the total GDP ends up being actually their addressable market. They just use software to get into that bigger market. And that's what I've found really intriguing about the difference of how people used to look at vertical SaaS, whereas what is the software market? And now I think people are looking at it as like, what is the total actual market of you know, food logistics or flooring? And at some point, they're going to take a basis point of every transaction that happens.
Yeah. What do you guys, so as Mark alluded to, you turn the rock over, you realize, hey, these guys are pen and paper, or maybe there are some of them are using an Excel sheet. Why build software specifically for them versus piecemealing things together that already exist? There's already email marketing out there. There's already CRM products out there. Why does it make sense to build specifically for a vertical?
I think there's this natural cycle in technology of bundling and unbundling, which is like, I mean, it's a common theme across a lot of different things. And I think that's what's going on here as well with a lot of vertical SaaS, where over the last decade or two, like you did have email took over and Salesforce took over, and there were all these general purpose tools for how, or, you know, horizontal tools in a sense for how people can upgrade communication in general, upgrade your Salesforce in general. And it kind of sets a new standard for how the world works. And what emerges out of that is all of these horizontal companies are solving for the general use case, and no one sends letters to anyone anymore. We send emails. But what that leaves opportunity for is someone to think about the problem from an industry specific place and build all of the stuff that will make email, for example, really, really, really mesh with the specific use cases of an industry. And I think that's where we are in the tech cycle where, you know, again, we've talked about how the internet is, you know, 10 or 20 years old at this point, and it's ubiquitous in all of our lives. And there's already this baseline of like, okay, like here's technology. And so the opportunities with vertical SaaS are, okay, like there's all of this technology that exists. So how do we adapt it and how do we mold it to the specifics of any individual industry, which is hard for someone to do if you're solving for that general use case.
Yeah, can I take that from I look at it a little bit differently, and it's probably our backgrounds being he's on the tech side and I'm, you know, kind of sales and marketing background, because for me, realistically, our software, our website, CRM, and our ERP each have one feature that make it unique to flooring. Like realistically, could you use this for any industry? Like the answer is yes. Could they get a website from Squarespace? The way we've looked at it though is, if you want to show inventory on your website and get real inventory from manufacturers, you have to work with a flooring specific software company because we have access to all the data. There's no aggregate API where you can just tap into and get access to thousands of manufacturers of data. You really would have to go to a flooring specific company to get that, who has the relationships to actually get those things. So where I'm going with this is, I actually think being vertical SaaS makes the customer service and the customer acquisition easier. I am constantly thinking about one customer, which makes my marketing much easier, which makes our sales much easier, which makes training people internally much easier, which means customer service easier. So I think from a business standpoint, from a CAC standpoint, from a retention standpoint, vertical SaaS is very, what's the right word I'm looking for? Is interesting. Less on the product, because I think all the products could be ubiquitously used across multiple industries, but more on how you operate efficiently to go after just one target customer versus multiple target customers.
Can I pull on a thread you got on earlier? You said, you know, you're looking at software sales, the initial market, and then you think about GDP, and I know you mean GDP in that market segment.
Exactly.
Can you give a sense of what the basic playbook is for vertical SaaS? Like, what's a software play? How does it expand to participate in the GDP as you described?
Sure. So I'll give our example, and I think everyone has a slightly different variation of this, but I do believe every vertical SaaS company ends up being some sort of percent of the transaction company, whether that's fintech. I think most people think of that through payment processing, right? That's like the obvious way. So my view of the playbook is you start with software, you get a big enough network that then you get into fintech, right? That's the most bread and butter thing that most people think of, because then you get a percent. For us, we make about $600 a month per retailer in software. But then if I'm getting 60 basis points or a full point on their credit card processing, well, that TAM is the $70 billion of flooring that's bought and sold every year. So I think that's bread and butter for most companies. I think what's interesting about our company, and I actually saw this recently with Slice, is they took it a step further where they now start offering their own brand of pizza boxes. Right? Because all of their pizza restaurants need pizza boxes. They can bulk buy it. They can then brand it, and they can make money on the supplies around the pizza restaurant, not just the credit card processing. For us, it's similar. In flooring, flooring is a commodity. So now what's happening is manufacturers who are making flooring are coming to us and saying, we want to launch our flooring product through you to your customers so we can offer this unique digital experience. So we're wedging our way in there. We couldn't do that if we were vertical SaaS for cars, right? Because cars each have their own brand. It's not a commodity. We wouldn't really be value. So for us, again, it's payments. And then we actually are able to get into the widget and the actual thing. But I think in other markets, that's not possible. Like, it's not like in food distribution, they're going to launch a You know, someone's going to go live with a new brand of tomatoes through them, but everyone has their own, you know, spin on that.
Yeah.
So we actually do
do you have your own brand of tomatoes?
We do not have a pepper brand of tomatoes, but one of the interesting things that's happened sort of to your point and to your point around, you know, every vertical SaaS company sort of has a wedge into the market. And then once you build a network of customers distribution and so forth, there's a lot of other people that want to participate in that network. And one of the dynamics that we're seeing is because we have a bunch of restaurants and grocery stores and convenience stores ordering digitally from wholesalers for basically the first time ever, what's happened is there's this very high intent digital surface that's super interesting to a bunch of food manufacturers and food brands out there. And these are all the brands, I mean, Nestle and ConAgra and Unilever that, you know, we all see on the shelves, and they have these huge consumer marketing arms that want to sell more stuff to more people. And they've always had a hard time replicating what they're doing on the consumer side and the B2B side because like this digital medium hasn't existed. And so one of the things that's been interesting recently is we've started to engage with these big brands, and a lot of them actually do want to launch, you know, hey, I've got this new brand of chicken wing that I want to push out to restaurants, or, you know, I have the new drizzle that I want to sell to, you know, a bunch of restaurants. And we're seeing that emerge as one of these interesting new use cases that, to your point, like just doesn't exist in a world before vertical SaaS. And so there's a, you know, that's just an example of sort of what you're saying around you're creating additional value beyond the existing TAM.
Yeah, I think it's like going after SaaS. It's like payments or distribution, right? Like we look at it as every software, every website or ERP we sell is a new customer as part of our distribution channel. And then who's interested in that distribution channel? For them, it could be a new, you know, whatever I said, tomato or a new chicken wing. And for us, it's a new flooring product. But in the day, like having distribution in one industry outside of just payment processing is a really interesting opportunity to go after the GDP of that industry specifically.
Yeah. And to your point, that's what makes the network so valuable, right? And what could potentially make you guys so valuable to an acquirer one day. I think the term we'd use on our side of the table is a SaaS-enabled marketplace. I think it's really interesting because I know in Pepper's history, and some of your competitors took different approaches to this market. Some said, hey, we're going to build a marketplace for goods, and we're going to let people, buyers and sellers, come on there and try to fix this market this way. You guys determined pretty early on that that wasn't the right way to go. And I think the more we've seen companies build, the more I think we think that most markets actually require or should be built as SaaS first, marketplace or distribution layer second, instead of marketplace first, SaaS second. I think just it gives such a unique moat to the business to really own that customer relationship, have the embedded software, own their website, right? Own their distribution, to then bring in things like advertising, to bring in things like flooring, to bring in things like your own tomato brand. And I think that's what's really exciting about the vertical SaaS industry too, because these are monster TAMs. Like to your point, flooring is $100 billion a year or whatever it is. And you're in a $1 trillion market, which is a number that most people can't even comprehend.
Well, it's like if I had 4,000 flooring retailers, that's really, really interesting to a flooring manufacturer. If I had 4,000 customers across multiple industries, that's essentially interesting to nobody.
Right. 4,000 flooring retailers, your point. If you, in the old days, the big flooring manufacturers would have to hire an army of salespeople
to get access to them.
They would drive around in Ford Tauruses door to door trying to sell flooring to all them across Nebraska. It would take weeks, months, years, steak dinners, et cetera. Now you own their website.
Yeah. So we can digitally do distribution and, you know, overnight.
Right.
One thing I think is so interesting about this is if you look at it from up the supply chain of venture capital, from like an LP perspective, they might have looked at the world before and said, hey, I want exposure to an industry. Who's the big player in the industry? I'm going to buy some of their stock on the public markets. Vertical SaaS represents a way to kind of get exposure to a broad industry across a lot of companies within. You're really indexing the industry. So from kind of like this diversification, financial exposure concept, a little bit abstracted from the day-to-day operations, it's very fascinating. It's a way to kind of buy in and ride a broader wave, not just an idiosyncratic company.
Yeah, it's good and bad in that way. Like our transactional revenue, listen, we're 90% recurring software revenue. So our balance is still, we're still in the recurring software revenue side of the business where we believe long-term transactional revenue will get us to hundreds of millions of revenue at much higher margin, but we're not there yet, but we are on the path and we're seeing the right traction. I will say that's good and bad, right? For us, when we're in 2020 and 2021, flooring retailers couldn't keep up with how much flooring they were selling. And for us to be in the transactional side, that was amazing, right? Every graph we showed up and to the right, up and to the right, up and to the right, Now, consumers are pulling back. I mean, I see it every single day with our flooring retailers, but our transactional side is then hit. And what's hard for investors is they're used to, like, you have your software side of the business, it's growing at whatever, 30% year over year, and like it just compounds. But then they have to wrap their minds around this like transactional side of the business that I think if you look over a 10-year period, goes up and to the right, but in a 1 year or 6 month or 2 year period is impacted by economics impacts or the vertical that you're in. So the exposure is good as long as you know what you're getting yourselves into and you have a broader look at it.
Yeah, totally. Switching gears for a second here, everyone's favorite topic du jour. Mark and I talked a little about this before, but what's the AI read in your industries? Now, I think we, you know, you read the news now and the overwhelming consensus that AI is going to be everywhere. It's going to steal your job. It's going to kidnap your kids. It's going to be, it's game over, right? You guys work in huge TAMs, right? The majority of Americans work at places and in roles that you guys are servicing, right? Or companies like yours. What's the read from your customers on AI? Do they expect it from you? Are you building it in a way that they'll never know it's there and it increases productivity? How are you guys thinking about this?
One of the things that was actually interesting and surprising to me in our industry is we talked about before, food distribution in general has been underpenetrated by technology, and you know, it's taken a while for the internet to get there and so forth. And I was actually surprised that at an industry conference last year, this is one of the trade groups that exists in the food distribution industry. They have a tech committee that talks about tech related things. And one of the topics at that tech committee meeting was actually AI. And what does AI mean for food distribution? So I was genuinely surprised by how quickly this AI thing has made its way like into our customer base. And I think it's playing out in a couple ways. So first things first, I think when people in our industry say AI, I think it's a broad term that just means like a computer is going to do something that I don't have to think about. And there are a lot of things that will fall into this AI category that a year or two ago we would have just thought of as like, hey, this is a push notification that happens when an event is triggered, or like, hey, here's like a customer alert when someone hasn't ordered in a while. And just the idea or people thinking about that as AI, I think is a reality, right? And so there's all of this reframing of some of the stuff that was just happening before that's more interesting because it can be framed in the AI light. The second thing that's happening is I think in general that a lot of the LLM stuff is a pretty good replacement for a lot of the e-commerce UIs that we have out there. And if you think about e-commerce, there are two major reasons why you're going to go to an e-commerce site. One is to browse and you're not sure what you want. And you know, for that, I think a lot of the UI experiences that we have like continue to make a lot of sense. And the second is you kind of know what you want and you just want to place your order. And for that, like there's no real reason to like fire up your Uber Eats app and find the restaurant you want, tap on it, go find the dish you want and tap on it. And it's much simpler to just be like, hey, I want like, you know, two tacos. And what compounds that in our industry is because it's historically been underpenetrated, there are a lot of customers that still place their orders in this way, right? They email their order to the sales rep or text it or leave a voicemail. And so the transition from that to an app is much bigger than the transition from that to, you know, okay, like now you're just texting a different number and like the AI will do it. So I think there's actually a huge opportunity to get greater penetration in the industry by enabling some of these AI forms of ordering. The third thing that I think is going to happen is, you know, there's a lot of ways that AI can just drive efficiency throughout the industry, right? And, you know, food distribution in general, I think, is an area where there are like hundreds and hundreds of manual tasks, right? You have someone that's in charge of figuring out whether or not payments have been processed. You have someone that's in charge of like answering random customer support questions. You have sales reps who have to go out there and like, okay, what are all the restaurants in the world? What do I say to them when I walk in? And I think there are a lot of things that AI and, you know, the LLM sense of the word can do to help make a lot of those decision-making easier. So one of the things that we're investing in right now is a set of tools to help distributor sales representatives transition from a world where primarily they're just taking orders as they come in via text and email to a world where they're actually out there like building the business. And so, you know, if you're out standing in the middle of New York City, like what are the restaurants around you that don't buy from you? What are their menus? And how can we map their menus to items in your catalog and give you a playbook for what to say to that restaurant when you walk in so that you can make a compelling pitch? So those are some of the ways that I think AI is going to help our customers. And then internally for us, I think, you know, we're already experimenting with AI in terms of efficiency in a number of ways. One of the things that we do a lot of is integrations between Pepper and various ERP systems. And if you think about what those are, it's really a mapping of one data structure to another. And that's something that, you know, LLMs as they stand are actually pretty good at. And so we've seen some success where, you know, LLMs can help our integrations be written faster and help us debug things when things are going wrong.
Yeah, I would totally agree with all of that. I think for us, listen, our customer biggest pain point today is they can't find people to install the floors that they sell. So most of what they're thinking about is like, how do I get blue collar people to tradespeople to install the flooring? Now, our version of AI at this point is like we offer an email marketing solution and there's some AI. But again, it's like predict on what day and time that email should be sent. That I think that's been around for a while. We're using AI mostly internally. Like a good example, I think you just mentioned it on like data mapping. We have an ERP system. Onboarding on an ERP is painful. Well, how can I take that process from 9 months to 4 months or 3 months? And that gets your customer satisfaction up. That gets you launched higher. It reduces our churn. I'll put this in real numbers. I mean, we've adopted a lot of AI internally. And over the last, we were just talking about 2 years, we went from burning $12 million a year to last year six. And this year will be less than one. And a lot of that is attributed to AI tools internally that are just making us more efficient. And we need less people and our current people can do a lot more. So that's where we're focused on it. And by us obviously losing less money and still growing, we can then invest in other things. So I think our customers are getting benefits from AI even more than they realize without them seeing an AI tool. It's because we're using it internally, becoming more efficient and better of a business. We can invest in other products that are like right now necessary. I think all of us will have to at some point have an AI product for our customers to offer. We're not going to jump into the gun right now in our industry when there's a long list of things that are a problem. But eventually I could see us getting into something customer facing in AI. It's just not, we don't need to do that right now. It's more internal for us.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting point though, that maybe some people haven't thought about or failed to realize, which is as companies get more productive leveraging tools for AI, the net beneficiary of that is A, the shareholders, the investors like us and others, but also the customer base. They're going to win by effect of companies shipping products faster, shipping products better, shipping products more efficiently, bringing costs down so that they can have cheaper products, which again, is a huge value prop of vertical SaaS to take things full circle here.
I've actually seen this a little bit. We were just having this conversation, but I think we went through this like outsourcing wave when everyone went remote, that opened up like outsourcing and remote work. And now what I'm seeing with a lot of these vertical SaaS companies, because listen, in vertical SaaS, you only have a finite number of customers. I only have 20,000 flooring retailers. And even as part of our pitch, when we sell product, we say, you know, someone says, I have a website and a CRM with local agency X. And I say, that's awesome. If you don't work successfully with them, they're going to go find a pizza shop or a barber shop or anyone else that they're going to sell to. To me, there's only 20,000 flooring retailers. So I need to be unbelievably successful with you and make sure that like, if we burn a bridge with you, now we have 19,999 customers. There's not like another billion customers we can go after. And in vertical SaaS, like the numbers we look at are net retention, right? A very important metric for vertical SaaS, especially because vertical SaaS companies don't grow at 300% year over year. You start at a point where it just compounds 30%, you know, every single year. And where I'm going with this is I think a lot of these horizontal companies have outsourced a lot of support and other functions because they don't have to maintain that customer base so well and keep that NPS score so high. So like for us, we've never outsourced any support, any of that type of stuff. Instead, what we've done is been able to keep that in-house and use AI to make our current account management teams, CX teams more efficient, which is very important in vertical SaaS.
Any chance you have a ratio, an operating metric you track where you're thinking like number of customers per customer service person, that you've seen that number shift? Like it's that they can go from supporting 25 to 50 now.
I don't even know the number. I just know that we each of our customer success managers used to manage about 125 people. Now they're managing about 200, but I think the sky is, and the same level of service is there, to be clear. I'm not like degrading service. Like the service is everything for us because I only have 20,000 customers.
They're so bionic.
we have to, we overserve our customers. Like if you were to look at our CX team, it's still too much to service our customers. But being in vertical SaaS, I only have 20,000. So my bet, and I think everyone's bet in vertical SaaS, is once you open up the wallet, the net retention grows year over year over year, but you can't lose those customers, because if you lose them, they're never coming back and they're finite. So we've been able to double it at this point, but I think the sky is the limit there.
Awesome. Gentlemen, thank you so much for the time. Super insightful. We're so appreciative that you let us invest in your companies and support you guys, and excited to keep doing it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it. All right. I thought that was a great session. Pretty raw, candid characterizations of how they're thinking about the market and their businesses. Hopefully it was instructive, and we'll catch you again next week.